Tonight on Standing Room Only, Trans in Indiana, a Bloomington Conversation.
Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
On August 26th, the American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana and Bloomington Pride teamed up to hold a panel and discussion about transgender experiences. The conversation was part of a statewide series from the ACLU about transgender education and advocacy. The event was held at Monroe Public Library.
Welcome. Thank you for coming. We are nervous and excited to be here, and I'm hoping that we'll get a great conversation going today. We have some basic questions to start off with to kind of introduce ourselves and what we're doing, who we are, how we got here. And then we will open it up for Q&A, which is pretty loose and open. And I hope that you engage us in answer any, so we can answer any questions that you might have. I would like to do introductions first, if that's all right. And I'll start with LB.
Okay. So, hi, my name is LB. My pronouns are she, hers, and they, them. And a little bit about myself real quick. So, I'm a transplant to Bloomington. I originally grew up in Northern Illinois. I've lived here for the second time about 17 years. I am a veteran of the Armed Forces. I started transitioning about, I guess, it's almost been almost 2 years. They were mentioning about TASS. We formed a group, a support group for trans folks called Transgender and Ally Support Community. It was in about September or November that we felt just like a concern about supporting each other and stuff. So we started then. We meet here at the library once a week. And we have, and so we have a Facebook presence and stuff too. So, because our rooms and stuff switch, but in general we try to meet here. So that's been a really good thing. And then Melanie and myself were involved with the ACLU of Indiana's Transgender Education and Advocacy Program. So this is kind of like one of the things that we'll try to be doing into the future is like doing community conversations about what it means to be trans. So that's all I got.
My name's Riley. He, his. I started hormone therapy about 16 years ago. I lived as an out lesbian for about 6 years prior to that. I'm originally from Indiana, but I'm an Army brat, so I'm kind of from everywhere. Got with LB about TASS because Donald Trump scares the shit out of me. And so that's kind of where we're at.
My name's Laura. My pronouns are they, them. I'm a two-spirited indigenous person. And I can answer more questions if you folks have some. My gender is called Ndeshchan in the Apache language, and I grew up in Indianapolis. My family's from South Texas in Mexico.
I am Evelyn. I use she or they. So I am a fat trans lesbian, survivor of domestic violence, or survivor of sexual violence. I'm a sexual violence preventionist and activist. I work with Middleway House, which is a local domestic violence shelter and rape crisis center. It's like two blocks that way. That's not going to translate onto the radio. It's my basic stuff. I do a lot of work with local community groups. And if you find me later, I'll either be tabling with TASC or with Middleway.
Thank you. I didn't introduce myself. My name is Melanie Davis. I came out 20 years ago, I'm a mom here in town. I've been here 8.5 years, and I have been involved with a few different movements and things. This is TASC is my, and TEEP are my first real organized pushes though for this. We heard some about identity, and I would like to say there are lots of new words that you might hear out there in regarding identity, non-binary, genderqueer, two-spirit, that you might not be familiar with. I would like to ask our panelists how they identify and what that means to them.
Can I just go down the line?
You can go down the line, or anybody want to take?
I don't mind starting, I guess. I guess for me, like if I have to be sort of labeled, I would identify as a trans woman. And that's sort of more on a personal level that I would say that I'm a trans woman to friends and things like that or close acquaintances. On my Facebook, it just says woman. So that's kind of how I present myself. My reality and how I feel, like, I mean, I was born a certain way, I guess, and assigned at birth a certain way. And so it's hard for me to say, like, you know, because I have sisters and stuff, and I grew up with them, to say, like, my experiences, like, were parallel to theirs. And that's the thing, too. So when I say, like, I came out, like, 2 years ago, the reality of it is that, like, I wasn't just trans 2 years ago, like, I probably more openly realized that, but I'd really been trans my whole life. So that really sort of colors my experiences and how I experienced life. So, like, if you'd have known me prior to that, you might have said, like, oh, that person, like, really seems male or presents male and stuff like that. But the reality is I struggled with that and probably wasn't real successful in being that way. So, yeah, that's kind of me.
I say I identify as a trans man, but I have not shut off my experience in a female body that I had before. Because that's who made me who I am, so I kind of embrace that. So for me, I present as a trans man, but I know that I am a combination of both because of my experience. And I have no problem with that. So that's kind of who I am.
So like I said, I'm two-spirit. If you're unfamiliar with the term, it's kind of an umbrella term that was coined in the 1990s for Native American gender identities. And a lot of people think that two-spirit is like the Native American version of LGBT. I've heard people say that before. It's really not equitable. Some tribes had three genders, some four, some five. So, you know, I identify, like, if, you know, when I talk to people who are really, like, unfamiliar with it without wanting to go into a longer explanation, I'll tell people, you know, I'm queer or I'm non-binary, queer indigenous, you know, but, you know, I was, you know, identified female at birth and kind of, you know, as a child, people trying to put me in these little boxes, and you know, my gender identity is something I've really struggled with throughout my adult life. And after, because my parents were a bit colonized and Christian as well, and it was kind of a combination of Christianity and traditional Apache spirituality, and it was really confusing. You know, it wasn't until I was an adult when I kind of found the two-spirit community, like, nationwide, that I really kind of understood my place within the world and within my culture and within that context. And so it's kind of been a process for me, I guess, which it probably is for a lot of people. And yeah.
So, I'm Evelyn. I would consider myself, just in terms of identity and like labels, probably a non-binary trans lesbian. And actually, all parts of those are important to me. So I know, sort of like one of those trans 101 things is like sexuality and gender aren't the same thing, and they're not. But I definitely experience them as kind of like mutually reinforcing. They only make sense in the context of one another. Often I will describe myself as a trans woman because that reflects a lot of my lived experience. That is more or less what my life path has looked like if you're going to map it onto something that's legible. But as probably most people, it's a lot more complicated.
And just to let everybody know, if you don't know already, trans folks' relationship with the medical community is very complex, and in some ways has not evolved very much. There's a gatekeeping sort of aspect to it, where you have these supposed benevolent people above who are looking out for us, but might not have the training required to actually work with us to understand what we need, to understand the issues that are affecting us socially and with income, with access to insurance. The United States is very black and white in that still. Can I ask what your experiences have been with the medical community and with accessing either trans-specific or even general care?
I don't mind answering.
I mean, on paper, like, there is no other box. So when you go to the doctor's office, so on paper, you know, I'm listed at my doctor's office as female. And I did have a breast reduction 10 years ago now. And it was partially because of medical reasons because of my back, but also, you know, like I was able to get my insurance to pay for it because of the damage it caused to my back, but also I was really, really grateful that I was able to do that because I was really uncomfortable with that part of my body. And, you know, I do occasionally like to, you know, bind, sometimes I don't, and a lot of times I just don't wear a bra, but, you know, like, so that was something I was really grateful to be able to do, but I kind of had to work the system in order to be able to do that. And I know that not everybody is fortunate enough to be able to have that experience, and I'm very grateful that I was able to. I mean, it was extremely painful recovery. I couldn't wash my own hair for 2 weeks because I couldn't lift my arms over my head, but it's like the best decision I ever made as far as my own body goes.
I think that, like, for me, access to medical care was a huge thing, and probably one of the reasons why I did come out, having sort of come to the real, well, it is complicated, but because I was so much later in life, we use the term sort of suffered from testosterone poisoning, which, you know, might include, you know, things like male pattern baldness and things like that, which, you know, if you're a cis woman or whatever, having alopecia is like a huge thing. It's very like, because, you know, women don't walk around missing pieces of their hair on their head. And so as a trans woman, you know, you've experienced these things or whatever. So when it's like you say, like, that just becomes another barrier. So when you're looking at transitioning and you're looking at your body and you're going, I'm this age, I can't do this, like I can't plausibly feel like I can be who I am without medical intervention, without being on hormones and then maybe possibly surgical intervention, you know, depending on your sort of needs and your psychological state. And so yeah, having access to medical care is very important. And for me, you know, I have excellent insurance. I'm a Teamster, and we have excellent insurance coverage. But in that policy, there was a wording there that said that transsexualism in any sort of form would not be covered. And so that was always a deterrent for me. But then when I joined the Army late in life at about 41, and then I got out and I was able to access VA medical care. And there had been a directive written in, I think it was 2012 or 2013, directing the VA to cover or to provide medical care to trans folks. And that was when I got out in 2014, I saw this. And I was also hearing lots of people that had been in the military, you know, like there was a lot of trans folks that had been in the military for whatever reason. Like we serve, like as a group, we serve at like twice the rate of like cis people. Oftentimes we're trying to find ourselves. But anyhow, so the point of it is that I was able to access that care, and then the directive had been written to provide that care. So to me, it really allowed me to say, yes, I can make this decision and have that care. So that was a huge thing. Otherwise, I don't know what I'd be. I wouldn't be sitting here right now, I can tell you that. So
I've paid for everything out of pocket because I haven't had anything go through insurance. So my hormones I pay out of pocket. And my wife and I do not make that much money. So it's not that we can afford it. It's just how it has to happen. And when I had my chest reconstruction surgery, the only way I was able to pay for that was my mom gave me the money after my dad passed away from the life insurance policy. I've had doctors tell me they will not treat me because they don't understand being trans. And even after my chest reconstruction surgery, the nurse called to check in on me the next day and misgendered me on the phone. I was like, I was just there at your office having this horribly rough surgery, and you misgendered me. I have a good doctor now here in Bloomington. I pretty much pay for everything out of pocket because we also don't have health insurance because we can't afford it. So she works with me. But I've had a doctor in Indianapolis who just got shut down all of a sudden. I've had doctors move away, and then trying to find someone who will do hormone therapy is next to impossible. So that's kind of been the way, and then you have to jump through so many hoops anyway to get started on hormones that I kind of bypass that altogether, but most people don't have that ability. But that's been my experience with healthcare.
Say, like, as a person who comes from, relatively speaking, like a privileged background, my family is solidly middle class, very white. I think for me, the medical system was like the first step in a rude awakening about how these systems work to victimize and exploit marginalized people. I have been sexually harassed by doctors. I have had doctors refuse care and still charge me. All sorts of nightmare scenarios. And I can't say whether or not my experiences are unusual. I do think that it makes it really clear that, like, the medical system is an institution just the same as any other institution, just the same as schools, just the same as the church and all these others. And, like, it can help people get things they need. It's not set up to. That's not its purpose. So, yeah. I'm not bitter. Sorry.
Right now.
That issue, the medical issue, is huge in our personal lives, and it contributes to other problems in our social lives, and there's plenty enough going on there. Kit was talking about how she was gonna pull out some statistics and some scary numbers and things, and I just go down a couple here because I want to kind of set up for the next section. 26, according to a couple of very well publicized trans-wide surveys over the past 5 years, 4 years, they came up with some of these numbers just to kind of illustrate what our experiences have been, mostly on the negative side, for just getting a handle on on things and where we're at. 26% have lost their jobs due to being trans. And 19% have experienced familial violence because of their transness. The one really hard one is the really big one. Of the people who are able to respond and say that they had attempted suicide, 41% of us, the survivors, 41% of us have reportedly attempted suicide. And back in the early 90s, when I was still trying to figure out what was going on and what I was and who I was, and there was just anecdotal evidence going around online, the rate that was being reported was somewhere over 50% by a group that was around at the time have attempted overall. And I think that's horrific when the national average is 4.7%. And a lot goes into that. A lot goes into contemplating such things and what brings you to that point is often the problem that we've had with interaction with society in general, and the negative effects of that. And on that note, I'd like to bring the question, if you want to talk about it, if you've experienced discrimination, how, and what happened from that? How has it affected you?
I used to work a security job when I lived on the East Coast, and they told me that I could only use the women's restroom. And at the time, I had started to grow facial hair, and I refused. And I ended up getting a kidney infection, and I ended up having to go to the hospital. The nurse at the hospital was nice, but this was after I came out to my workplace and told them that I was trans. And I was doing security at a factory, and they wanted me to only use the women's restroom. So that was one instance that I've had issues.
I had a similar experience at work. And at least on my driver's license, I had a F designation for my gender. But at work, and I work at a Fortune 50, 100 company, it's up there. And a conversation came up about me using the bathroom. And it's a very male dominated industry that I work in. And so the male restroom has like four stalls, and then the women's restroom has like one. It does have a locking door though. And I brought that up. I said that, you know, like, well, it's got a locking door. It's just like a single person bathroom anyhow. You know, why should I use the other one? Because I knew like where I was going, where this direction was heading and stuff. And I was out at work, you know, and they knew, and I had gotten legal documents and things to them and stuff. So that had happened. But the question came up like that some other people felt uncomfortable that with the idea that I was using that bathroom, not that we would be in there at the same time. And I just said, you know, and they were suggesting that possibly I could use a different, like it would be my bathroom or something. Along with the mops and things like that. And I was just like, no, I don't think so. I'm not going down that road. Because if I go there, then I'm never going to get back. So I said no. And luckily, I'm in a union. So if it got down to it, you know, it definitely could get to be a dragged out battle. But they acquiesced and because it was easier, you know. But and so I kept my job. But I had mentioned access to health care. The other big thing that I'd always worried about was transitioning in work, because I wouldn't be able, I didn't think that I would be able to survive without being able to have the job that I had. I think it would be very hard for me to find another job, and I've been there a long time. I've been there over 21 years. And I've worked with these people, you know, at this place for the last, like, 16, 17 years. And it took, that was a big thing, to have that courage or whatever. But, you know, the corporate policy was inclusive, in, at least in words and stuff. So that made a huge difference. But that was one of my experiences as far as discrimination and worrying about being able to be unemployed, because that has a huge effect on you living.
I mean, I'm only out to, like, about my gender identity to only a couple of people at work. Most people at work just think I'm, like, a queer woman, and I only have a few friends at work that I've, like, told, these are my preferred pronouns, you know, all of that, because I am worried about how people that aren't, that people are going to react. Like, there was a woman who used to work with me, and it was a couple years, or last year, and she, like, worked the front desk, and this was, like, the worst person to have working the front desk, and it was cloudy out, and she's, like, said something to me about the weather. I said, yeah, I hope it clears up before, you know, I get off of work. And she's like, oh, well, what are you doing after work? And I said, well, I'm going to the IU auditorium to see Bernie Sanders speak. And she started going off about, you know, first she started talking about how they need to put God back in schools, and then she started going on and just, like, all these different, like, and I was just kind of like, okay, and trying to, like, back away from this conversation. And then she starts going off about how trans people are disgusting, and how you know, her daughter had to write a paper about it in high school, so she's somehow an authority on this issue, and all of that. And I finally just was like, you know what, I am not comfortable with this conversation anymore. I, you know, and thankfully a couple other people, like, stepped in and came to my aid and, like, got her to shut up, because, and apparently this was a common thing. They would call it being this person's first name when she would, like, trap you into these conversations. And I went back upstairs, and I was shaking, and my boss was like, are you okay? And so I reported it to HR and all of this. And then after, like, a week or two, they called me into the HR office, and they were like, well, everybody was uncomfortable with that conversation. So, and I'm like, I didn't even, like, she just starts talking about this out of, so that's why I'm not really out at work, because, like, you know, I don't want people to, you know, the fact, especially the HR was just like, well, everybody was uncomfortable with it. I'm like, I was the one being, like, verbally accosted, so, yeah.
And I have a variety of anecdotes. 10 years gifted a lot of gross people. Been denied housing, medical care, promotion at work, and even in spaces where I have felt more or less good, I've still had bosses who've said really gross things, particularly in the field that I work in now, which historically actually hasn't, so I work in sexual violence prevention, historically has not actually been super accessible to trans folk and trans women especially. One thing I do like to highlight when we sort of bring this question up about violence and discrimination is the way that these disparities play out within trans communities, so especially trans women of color, are dramatically more vulnerable to these particular kinds of violence. Trans women with disabilities also. All of these experiences are important. I think that's also an important context to have when we try and make policy or changes or we do trainings or whatever. To try and keep these things from happening in the future, is that it's multiply marginalized trans folk who are most at risk of experiencing this kinds of violence, these kinds of discrimination.
I have a lot of friends in the two-spirited community who are trans women of color, obviously. I guess that's implied. So I've, you know, heard firsthand from them their experiences and the kinds of discrimination that they've faced, and, you know, it's really frightening.
You've been listening to Trans in Indiana, a Bloomington conversation on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to four panelists discuss transgender experiences at an event hosted by the Indiana American Civil Liberties Union and Bloomington Pride. We now return to the show with panelists talking about transgender experiences. The discussion is part of a statewide series from the ACLU about transgender education and advocacy.
There's a lot going on in the media. I'm sure you've heard plenty of issues being bandied about concerning civil rights, what are civil rights for trans folk, and how that's evolving. And there are many new developments every day. So I want to ask, what are your greatest concerns about the current civil rights milieu, if I said that right, I'm not a French speaker, today?
I feel like we've become giant targets. And I don't know if it's because when President Obama was in office, there were so many great things happening. That now there's this giant pushback, but I feel like for some reason we're being obsessed about, and it seemed to just, it all happened as soon as Trump came into office, because, you know, he makes everything okay to be horrible, and I think that's, I mean, there's this green flag to being awful to us now. And there's very few people who will step up and say that's not right, because there's violence that's come along with that too. It just seems to be so much worse than it was. I mean, I was hesitant about doing this panel because I knew my face would be out there. I was hesitant about doing this panel because I was afraid of security here in the library. I've never felt that before, ever. It wasn't until just recently that I've actually been afraid to be out and to make it known that I'm trans. And that's not who I am. I've never been that person. So it's, I don't know. And I don't know what's going to change that back. But there's just, I don't know.
As a person of color, I've always had that target on my back. My mother is white and Turkish, and my father is Native American. I grew up in a more Native American household. I speak Apache. I noticed as a very small child how I would get treated differently versus if I was out with my father than my mother. People could tell me to go back to Mexico my whole life. I had, you know, and as a kid, it was very confusing because I'm like, I'm not from Mexico. I knew my family is from Mexico, and I understand Spanish, but I don't really speak it, and, you know, whatever. But, you know, I was like, I'm from Indianapolis. Like, what are you talking about? And, my father, you know, he moved to Linton, Indiana, and I don't know why. I think he's like the only person on earth to move to Linton. And
it's a nice place.
And he, you know, has a concealed carry permit and a handgun. And then the Philander Castile shooting happened. And I called my dad, and I'm like, please don't bring your gun places, because I don't want you to get shot if you get pulled over. And he's like, well, it wouldn't happen here. I'm like, you say that until it happens. You're like the only brown person in town. There's maybe like two of you. Like, I, you know, and so that target has always existed on me. Especially being from a border people, you know, we existed there before that border existed there. And the, discrimination that we face along that southern border, that is not experienced by people along the northern border of our country, it's very scary, and it has been my whole life. Even, you know, before Build the Wall happened, before all of that happened, that, you know, discrimination of people that come from along that border has been there. And unfortunately, though, have few spaces where I feel like I can really be authentically myself, and that I feel like those spaces are getting smaller and smaller. Especially with some things that happened this year and, you know, leaving the roller derby league that I was a member of and all of that. Like, I'm losing a lot of the spaces where I feel comfortable with being who I am.
I think I'm half Mexican, so I kind of grew up with some of that stuff. I had racial slurs thrown at me as a kid. And, as I grew older, I appeared more white and kind of really turned my back on that part of my of who I was, my identity. But it does kind of other you. And that's just one of the things, like, so we talk about civil rights or whatever. And that was one element of, like, more recently where I felt like the political climate and the things that were being said, that when they talk about, you know, this build a wall and throw that out as a chant and stuff, that that a lot of white folks just look, they can't tell the difference between a brown person, whether that they like are here legally or were born here. We just get all thrown in together. And like, so when they say those things, like, and when that part of my family, when we hear those things, we only interpret it as one way. Like, we say that's we feel it as racism, and people say no, that's not what it's about. It's about these people that are here illegally or whatever. That's what it's about. And it's like, yeah, but y'all can't tell the difference, and that's just one thing of it. And then more recently, being a veteran, and technically I'm still in. I'm in the individual ready reserves for another year, so I could be called up. I haven't officially notified my chain of command that I'm transitioning, even though legally I've done it, my passport and everything else, because it was kind of like, well, what's the likelihood I'll get called up? But then with the transgender ban in the military, which was done in a very sort of, I feel like, just, you know, sort of spray painted on a wall as sort of a way it was given to us, was fairly disrespectful. And let's see, where am I going with this? Oh, so, but like, the fact of it is that there are people that are serving, apparently between like 1,500 to like maybe 4,000 or 5,000, maybe even more. It's kind of not really a discrete number, but there's a lot of us that serve. And like I had said, like, it was an active duty staff sergeant in the infantry, Patricia King, who came out when the law was, the ban was lifted, and she came out, and that was one of my inspirations for coming out and gave me that courage to do that. And whatever your beliefs are as far as the military, you know, and our aggressions and things throughout the world, or however you view it, or if they're the greatest freedom fighters in the world to you, but the fact of it is that these people had given themselves to this service. Many have been doing it for quite a while, and had were told they could come out and that it was safe, and then it turned out it wasn't. And some of these people have been serving, you know, almost 20 years. And I think it's just a culmination of all those things and stuff, you know, the racism, the veterans issues and stuff, and being called out, you know, as far as being transgender, because the intersectionality of all of that starts to really, like, play against who we are and being out and feeling we can be part of the commons of this nation. And it really sends a strong signal that we can't. And that's hard, because it's like every day you just feel that little bit constantly. And that's, for me, like, that's really kind of the core of, like, this, like, where we need to stand strong, we need to have solidarity, we need to stand with other communities. It's like, here we are, this very diverse group of people, and we're fighting back against this group that seems very homogenous. And it's frustrating, but I have hope that y'all are here, you know, and we're all standing up for this. But yeah, that's some of my feelings about it. It's, you know, what does all of this mean? Where is it going for this country. So, anyhow.
And that, very succinctly puts a magnifying glass over the different issues that we're facing just today. I mean, when we were getting together and trying to figure out how we were going to put this panel together and what we were going to talk about and all the different questions and ways it could go, half the discussions that we could have weren't really even brought to the fore. Things are changing so fast. Texas just dropped the ban on bathroom ban that had been going through their system for a while statewide, but they still have Houston's got some civil rights issue problems. The military ban just came back up, where now there's 6 months, I think it is, for the military, it's put onto them to figure out how they're going to ban us from service. Which is an odd thing, and to be honest, the military doesn't want to. This is coming through, and it's being pushed through as a part of a legislative package, it seems, across the country. We have RFRA laws targeting people's ability to freely speak their minds and to act in discriminatory ways. Tennessee has, specifically, I'll call them out, they have a law supporting students who want to chant and bully, homophobic and transphobic things to other students as a part of free speech. It's been, the First Amendment is being pulled out as a cudgel. And Charlottesville, where they felt the strength to come out and, although they were kind of shut down later on, San Francisco is not going to have their little meeting. We have, Illinois has just passed, the governor has signed a bill saying that trans folk and intersex folk who are trying to get their gender markers changed on their birth certificates, which is really an essential part of many people's transition because it impacts so much of their lives. They're dropping the requirement of having gender confirmation surgery or sexual reassignment surgery or the sex change or however it's being said in the next couple months, but and that is huge. When I had my markers changed and name changed, Indiana didn't have an official requirement, so I kind of squeaked through. Most trans folk have a hard time or will never have gender confirmation surgery, so having these legal avenues toward publicly and socially transitioning into an authentic life are essential. And I think it's 18 states have protections for us, and maybe that will grow. And however, all the rest of the states, it's perfectly legal to discriminate in housing, in employment, in services, public services, against us. And every day we hear more about pushes. There were 100 and, I'm forgetting the number, 100 and some pieces of legislation at the beginning of this year in the big right push toward dampening our rights as citizens, LGBT, sometimes just transgender rights, pushed through state legislatures and local places, and that's huge. That is, it's a tidal wave. And thanks to many of you and allies and family, there's a big pushback, and I'm encouraged. What do you think we can do to push back, to get momentum going in the opposite direction?
Well, something you brought up a minute ago, I kind of wanted to touch on, if that's okay. You mentioned people, you know, hiding behind the banner of free speech. And I feel like the idea of free speech is something that you hear thrown around more and more lately, and that people are, you know, are using to try to say that they have the right to say whatever they want. But free speech doesn't mean, like, free speech means you can say what you want without fear of persecution from the government, with the exception of, like, maybe a few things. But it doesn't mean I have to listen to you. It doesn't mean I have to give you a platform to say whatever you want. And so, like, with things like with Charlottesville, and, you know, I am a parent of children who are Jewish and Native American, and I am Native American, and it's terrifying to see these videos of people, and they're saying Jews will not replace us, and that free speech. Or one of the guys in one of the videos was like, "Well, I don't give a crap about Native Americans. This is kind of edited for I don't give an F about Native Americans. We conquered them. We killed them all." You know, listening to people, and then they say that, and then they try to hide behind this banner of free speech. Like, no, that's not how it works, and it's not like I don't. And people are getting mad when people are getting their, you know, their speakers canceled or whatever. But you know what? Like, people are saying, no, we don't want to listen to this. This is not acceptable to speak hate like this around and then try to say you have a right to speak hate and you have a right to call for my death. Like, that's not how it works. So, yeah.
And to that point, there is something that hasn't been brought up in the media enough, I think. In Europe and other parts of the world, there's hate speech, and that's an excluded part of free speech. If you say something hateful, that might be illegal. And here in the United States, we have something like that. It's fighting words. And I learned about that in grade school, and I kind of carried it with me. But fighting words are words that are meant to incite violence at the moment, and they're meant to cause a reaction in people. Immediate visceral harm might happen, but harm socially, emotionally, is also not legal. And we have to remember that free speech is great, but there are limits, and there are things that we can do to stand up against and say, look, this isn't just free speech. This is what you're doing is hurtful and is harmful and is not even legal, possibly. Let me go back to this. I got kind of wrapped up. Would anybody else like to speak on how they feel that we can secure civil rights, how we can move forward?
So, I mean, I guess I'm, like, one thing I'm thinking about here is that, like, I'm less afraid of specific policy implications. As folks mentioned, like, some of us have always had targets on our back. I think, and because I've seen this play out in other communities, this is something that happened to the cis, gay, and lesbian community, especially back in the 60s with the Red Scare. Respectability becomes like a really, really tempting target. It becomes really, really tempting to try to appeal to like a kind of citizenship that is legitimate. That will not keep us safe. It will leave behind the most marginalized among us. I fear that these policies, which are designed to exclude but often leave space for those of us who can perform respectability, who can perform whiteness, like appropriately, right? That they will lead us to leave behind internally the folks who most need help. We will not win. So we will not succeed by being innocent. Yes.
Just to ask, could we define, for folks in the audience who might not know, could we define that term cis or cisgender?
Oh, sure. Cisgender is a term that refers to folks whose gender identity and experience of gender aligns more or less with the gender assigned to them at birth.
Oh, yeah, we skipped the definitions part.
Yeah, I didn't even have any slides.
I think for me, and this is called a community conversation, right? So, putting ourselves out there and sharing our experiences so that people who are kind of in the middle and haven't made up their minds of like how they feel about trans folks can see that we're real, that we are parts of communities, that we have, we have jobs or we have families, we have, friends, we're doing things, we're real people. We're not just some sort of like category that can be like dismissed, that we're part of this this country. I think that's the idea kind of behind this, to share our experiences so that people can see us as like real and corporeal and our corporeal, whatever. I was like, it's flesh and blood. And I think that's important, but there's a lot of things going on, And this is something that a lot of us kind of get involved with. I know when Kit was with Freedom Indiana, the legislative session comes around, and so we have religious freedom. What's it called? Religious Freedom Rights Acts or RFRAs? Yeah, RFRAs or whatever. Largely in pushback of marriage equality. That there's that aspect too of having to, and there's some people that they're in there, they're talking to legislators and stuff. We need to be in there and support those groups or whatever, we need to support, monetarily or whatever, by donations and stuff, like groups like, Trans Lifeline, the Trans Assistance Project. There's groups out there that, that you can access, or even just donating. Bloomington Pride is, a task is now part of Bloomington Pride. Them putting this conversation on, having these educational outreach things are really important. So, but it's a multi-level type of involvement that we all really have to do, and it's hard. But it's easy, too, because like I said, there's a lot of us who, after the election, I had a really hard time getting up out of bed, and there was a lot of us that felt that way. But, eventually we get there, and it's really... It's easier to do that in a space when you look around and you're we're sharing this space together, and that we have solidarity and that people have your back. So that makes it easier to step out, because then you're not feeling like you're so under attack. But different, being involved legislatively, donating to groups, being involved with those groups, showing up in numbers to protests and things, I think, is also helpful to show that there's people out there that are going to stand up. And having these conversations, I think, is real helpful.
You've been listening to Trans in Indiana, a Bloomington conversation on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to four panelists discuss transgender experiences at an event hosted by the Indiana American Civil Liberties Union and Bloomington Pride.
Been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.